Hello, Tiger Nation. I am Byron Hulsey, headmaster at Woodbury Forest School, and I would like to welcome you to the Woodbury podcast series. This podcast consists of informal yet substantive conversations with alumni, faculty, staff, and students. The conversations explore how Woodbury's core values empowered alumni to build a solid foundation for their lives, how those core values are taught today by Woodbury teachers, and how those values are put into practice by today's students. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you enjoy. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Woodbury Podcast. We're lucky today to be joined by a guest who's a prominent writer and thinker, Wright Thompson. Welcome to the Woodbury Podcast. I'll just give a little bit more of an intro. Wright is the author of several books, two of which I've read, The Cost of These Dreams, which is a series of long-form biographical essays of sports figures in American and international renowned who are fascinating in their own right. And Mr. Thompson here has dug into their lives, and it's a great read. I highly recommend it. And then most recently has published a book on the murder of Emmett Till entitled The Barn. So he's been at Woodbury. We're lucky to have him here and to join the Woodbury Podcast. This is going to be fun, right? So thank you for joining me.
Oh, man, it's my pleasure. This is last night was really, it was a great crowd. And I mean, as you well know, it's a very impressive room of students. That's collectively far and away the best group of questions I've gotten. And also the hardest questions to answer. Like, normally the questions you can sort of roll on autopilot.
Yeah.
And these were thoughtful people with thoughtful questions. I really, really enjoyed it.
Right. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about your life, where you're from, how you became a writer, and maybe reflect a little bit on the power of place in your own journey.
Well, I'm from Clarksdale, Mississippi, which is a town that has a deep history of blues musicians.
Yeah.
It's also the home of the playwright Tennessee Williams,
uh-huh.
where he grew up. He grew up in my neighborhood where I grew up. You know, my family, we've been there a long time. We farm. I've always felt both deeply connected to the place, but also literally the land.
Yeah.
Like the actual dirt.
Yeah.
So I've always felt deeply rooted in that. I think I became a writer as a way of exploring that relationship between myself and then the place where I'm from and the dirt.
Yeah.
And I think the mechanism for that is I spent a lot of time writing about other people's sense of place.
Uh-huh.
Because it's so important to me.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's often a place of intersection. And whether that's writing about the barn or writing about, you know, the distillery where the Van Winkle family started in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, or whatever. I mean, I just think place is so important. You know, and you're looking out these windows, and I'm assuming all the people, most of the people listening have been here. It is spring at Woodbury Forest, and the flowers are out on the trees, and you just look through these windows, and, like, there's nowhere else you could be.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place.
So it's really, I woke up this morning early. The sun was coming up, like, 5:45. It's just incredible. Like, you know, dogwoods and azalea, and he was just like, oh, this is great. The tulips right there in front of the residence.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about growing up. You reflected last night on the relationship you have with your dad.
My father was a trial lawyer and a professional political fundraiser. You know, it was very interesting. I think that aphorism about, like, wanting for the next generation to have a better life,
mm-hmm. right.
a different life, was very, very real for him, I think, mm-hmm. how he grew up and the sort of the things that he inherited and the things that he wanted to not pass on were very important to him. You know, we talked last night, like, at length about, I was a student here at Woodbury for almost 1 year. One of the things that happened after I got kicked out was he and I, which would have been 94, it was actually 31 years ago to the day yesterday.
That's crazy.
Which is wild. But one of the things that was interesting is we had a lot of conversations about, and I actually think this is probably useful to talk about Woodbury, because he had a lot of conversations about why he had wanted me to come here, and almost none of those things had anything to do with me.
Interesting.
Because, you know, I looked out at that crowd last night, and I feel like for some people in the crowd, this is a life-changing opportunity.
Right.
And I think for other people in that crowd, this is an utter obligation.
Uh-huh.
And, like, that's a really interesting energy when you mm-hmm. think about a sense of place. You know, he and I'll never forget, we got in the car to drive home, and I was like, you know, 15 years, I'm like, this is going to be really bad. I sort of feel like that was the first day of our relationship, that when we actually sort of saw each other for the first time. Because mm-hmm. he basically copped to, hey, look, me sending you here had as much to do with me as it did with you, and I never really asked you what was important to you. So how about we both just agree to give each other another chance.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
And like, I really, when I think of the relationship with my father now in the sort of sepia-toned distance 20 years on of his passing, it feels like that was, it started that day and ended the day that he died. Mm. Like, I feel like, so it's just really interesting too, I mean, for people, because you think at the time, like, the worst thing to ever happen to you is actually like the best thing that ever, like, it's just, it's a useful thing to think about now as I'm a parent. There is no such thing as a good or bad experience. It's just whether or not you're learning from it.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you're like in a doom cycle of repeated mistakes. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I don't know, I thought that was really interesting. And it also sort of surprised me the way that it came, like, I wasn't, like, that's super private. And, but a student asked a question last night, which is where the answer came from. And so, like, I was in no way thinking, like, that's where I was going to land. I'm lucky I didn't start crying up there. Yeah. Like, I just was like, this is, but, like, there was a real sense of, like, a student asked a question, and then it sort of came, and I was like, oh, I didn't expect that to come out. But, like, that was a really important moment for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's really interesting, too, to, like, I talked about this with Ben Hale this morning, because I would love for him to write a book that is about 38 years of being around 15, 16, and 17-year-olds, and, like, what that does to your own sense of youth and what that does to the way you move through the world as an adult, sort of connected to a time and a place that becomes total sort of manufactured myth in our own minds as we grow up.
Totally.
And he's, like, really in it every day. And I just feel like he must, I feel like if you spend this much time around kids this age, you must understand something that other people don't.
Yeah.
And it's like air, it's just in the air. We just sat and had coffee in the fir tree.
Certainly in his air, that's for sure.
But I just love that idea that, like, that there is something fragile being protected here.
Woodbury's got its own mythology here, which you would understand and have been a part of. We just had Invite Back weekend at Woodbury, so lots of parents and kids were here last weekend, and I shared with one group of parents. One of my favorite writers is the Swiss psychologist, Carl Jung.
Oh, yeah.
And he said,
I just like to say Jungian. It makes me happy.
You sound really educated when you say that.
You do.
Carl Jung said, a child's greatest burden is the unlived life of its parents.
That's real.
As a dad myself, that's sobering to say the least, and it's a real it's a real guardrail for me.
I will tell you this: I mean, I caught myself not that long ago. Some friends of ours' kids go to as a freshman at a boarding school, and I just started thinking, like, I wonder where my girls might want to go.
Yeah.
And then I literally just thought, you don't need to have an opinion. You know what I mean? You're either trying to be your father or kill your father. I mean, not to be, like, overly reductive about it, but, like, there are sort of, I mean, you know, we've been talking about the murder of Emmett Till. One of the things I think about all the time is, you know, my father was a civil rights lawyer. All I wanted in the whole world was to be exactly like him and for him to, like me and be proud of me. And so now, imagine that my father had been the Grand Wizard of the Cahoma County Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah.
All I would have wanted in the entire world was to be the Grand Wizard.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I got very lucky, because I feel like we apply moral judgments to what are really functions of geography, time, space, and inheritance.
Yeah.
And, like,
Which
is just luck.
Yeah.
And, like, I had nothing to do with any of that.
Right.
That's just luck.
Yep.
I read this essay one time about the David Simon television show The Wire, and how basically he was saying there are two kinds of drama. There's Shakespearean drama. There's Greek drama where the gods have all of the power, and there's Shakespearean drama where the human beings have the power, and those are two very different things. But he said he always imagined The Wire to be a Greek drama, and the modern institutions that exert control over people's lives are the postmodern gods.
Yeah, interesting.
And so, like, I always, like, there's always sort of an interesting thing about, is free will, is that real? Like, how much agency do we really have?
Yeah.
And how much of, like, everything we're going to do is already, like,
already grooved.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. You said last night, it was powerful, that you used to think that the world was divided between good men and bad men, and now you believe it's really divided between brave men and cowards. And I know you mean men to include women too. But what do you think makes for a brave man or a brave woman? What is that?
Doing the right thing despite all of the things conspiring to keeping you from doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I don't ever want to do anything in public that makes my girls' lives harder at school. Mm. You know, sometimes I think about that all the time.
Yeah.
Like, there are all sorts of perfectly acceptable reasons to step back from the brink on stands that you know are the right thing to do.
Yeah.
It's interesting. My mom is out of control on Facebook sometimes. And I'm always like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. And she's like, I grew up in the 1960s. I was a senior in high school, Freedom Summer. Mm. I had no idea any of this was happening. None of us ever talked about it. And I promised myself that if I ever had the chance again, I would intentionally not be silent. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just keeping a promise to a younger version of myself. Mm. And I was like, all right, point taken.
Yeah.
Point taken. Sorry, Mom. If Mom ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. Uh-huh. But no, I mean, it is, I do think about that all the time, the degree to which you end up just sort of grooved by inheritance.
So you there are some heroes in your book, The Barn, mm-hmm. some brave folks who stepped up under enormous pressure.
Enormous pressure.
Tell us a little bit about one or two of those folks.
So there's Moses Wright, who was lifelong sharecropper, who is the first black man in Mississippi to ever accuse a white man of murder in open court. This was August of 1955. He testified, and then the death threats got so bad that he had to leave. He tried to make it to harvest, and he had to leave his last cotton crop in the fields. Mm. He had to give his dogs away. And there was a reporter from the Chicago Defender at his house the day he gave the dogs away. Mm. His dog was named Dallas, and he cried as the neighbor took it away. And this old man moved to Chicago. He got a job cleaning up after hours at a nightclub. I always thought it was very odd that his shift started at almost the exact same time the kidnappers came into his house to take his nephew. Mm-hmm. And then he just lived in exile. He never felt like he was from there. He's a country boy. He liked to hunt and fish and never, you know, all that was stripped away from him. He had this, the Illinois Central Railroad gave him and another old man a plot of land right by the railroad tracks in Argo Summit where they could plant a big garden. Mm-hmm. And these men loved it. They made mules out of wheelbarrows and they had, you know, growing okra and tomatoes and cucumbers and greens. And I just love the fact that the other old man who did it with him was the founder of the Black Panthers, Fred Hampton's mm-hmm. father. Mm. So it was Emmett Till's uncle and Fred Hampton's father, these old men tending a garden in suburban Chicago. And I love that image. Willie Reed is one that I really... Like, Willie was incredible. His name was Willie Reed. He was 18. He woke up that morning, was going to the store to get some stuff to cook for breakfast. The pickup truck with Emmett Till in the back turned right in front of him. He hid behind a well. He heard the murder. I mean, he heard the screams turned to whimpers. Heard it to the torture. I mean, the kid got pistol whipped to death. And then testified with everyone in his life telling him not to testify.
And he was 18?
He was 18. He got so many death threats that 2 days after he testified... He had to walk down the Trudor Rouville Road alone out to Rouville to Highway 8, where there was a car waiting to drive him to the Memphis airport. The guy driving that car was Medgar Evers in 1955. Yeah. They put him on an airplane, never been on an airplane, flew to St. Louis, changed airplanes, flew to Chicago, where he was met by the Chicago Police Department, who kept him sort of safe and got him to a family member's house. The Mississippi National Guard... Mm. Sent some people up almost just to go scare him, and he had a nervous breakdown. He ended up in a hospital ward. He changed his name from Willie Reed to Willie Lewis. He worked for years. He met this woman named Juliet. I think they were married for 12 years before she knew he had another name, and even longer before they knew he'd been a witness to this murder. She just knew that he had nightmares and would scream in his sleep. This goes on and on. He never says anything about it, and then in 2004, I think, he gets a knock on the door, and it's the FBI. And they're like, we're trying to reopen this case, which means we might need you to testify again, which means we would really appreciate it. The United States of America would like you to fly with us to Mississippi to walk us through your testimony.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to do it, but he agreed to do it. And so he goes down to Mississippi, and it's really interesting. Like, Dale Killinger, who was the main FBI agent, who's just a badass. I mean, Dale's 75th Ranger Battalion.
Yeah.
Like, combat airborne jumps. He's one of the few people who's got stars. Like, you know, real thing. He said, described how emotional it was to see Willie Lewis be an old man. And, you know, you used to have a family every 25 acres. So you got to think, like, rural Mississippi was actually incredibly populated in a way that it isn't now.
Yeah.
And there were houses all up and down every road. And he was an old man, and he was there, and every single sign of every single human being he had known in the first 18 years of his life had been wiped off the face of the earth, and there wasn't a single speck of dust to prove that any of them had ever been there at all. And yet somehow this barn was still standing there. And he sort of like, Dale said, he sort of like lost his balance a little bit because he watched Willie Lewis become Willie Reed again. Willie Reed went home, never really talked about it. He liked to sit in his chair, drink a six-pack of beer, and watch the Los Angeles Lakers play basketball. And one of the things his wife told me, she didn't really know if anybody in the neighborhood even knew the story. And she said, and then she got a washer and dryer delivered to her house, or a new stove or something. And they live in a really rough neighborhood in Inglewood on the south side of Chicago. So the delivery guys just dropped it on the curb. They wouldn't. They were like, we got to get out of here. And so she didn't know what she was going to do.
Yeah.
And she said, and these two guys on the corner, they came over and said, ma'am, can we help you carry this into your house? And she was like, oh, my God, that'd be incredible. These dudes carry this stove into her house, carried the old one out, and then she tried to pay them. And they said, no, ma'am, we will not take your money. We know what your husband did.
Oh, wow.
And it just this sense that, like it takes your breath away. Yeah. And she is hilarious. She's in her 80s. She works at one shift a week as a nurse, so she keeps all her licenses current because she's like, never know if I got to go get a job.
Yeah.
And she, every time I'm, like, when I'm in Chicago, last time I was in Chicago, I took her, we went to Gibson's and had a big lunch date, and we just laughed. And it was beautiful because, like, I was done asking her about Willie, because the book was done. And, like, we just were two human beings who liked each other having lunch. And we just laughed and laughed. And then we ordered dessert, and it must have been a fourth of a cake. This thing shows up, and we each have a piece, and I'm just like, like, I'll never forget us just rolling on the floor laughing at how big the dessert was. And I say all, I say all of that to say, Willie Reed's uncle, who had to move too, he died a year ago. Like, Juliet is still alive. This isn't ancient history. This is not, like, there are people touched by this who are alive. And it, that was really shocking. I guess it shouldn't have been, but it, for some reason that was really shocking to me. Because it just seemed so long ago. And then you start doing the math, and you're like, well, of course there are people alive.
And so was it, what was powerful last night is that, of course, many of the characters of yours in the barn are the ages of the boys who are at Woodbury right now.
Well, let me just tell you, I mean, I don't think that went unnoticed to them.
No, it was totally heard and received and like, felt.
You could, there was an energy change in the room when you started realizing they're like, oh, this is 14 to 18.
Yeah.
I mean, the two essential players in this thing, one of them was 14.
Yep.
One of them was 16. Wheeler Parker, Emmett Till was 14. Wheeler Parker was 16. Willie Reed was 18.
Yeah.
That is the exact, that's fourth, fifth, and sixth form. I think there's a reason that story resonates with people.
Yeah.
And I think it's that everybody can imagine their own kid. The worst thing that happened to me is I had to leave one very expensive private high school and go to another expensive private high school.
Yeah.
So, like, I didn't have any real consequences for being a jackass.
Yeah.
But, like, they were playing where Emmett Till did something a little cheeky and got tortured to death for it.
Right.
For being a teenage boy.
Yeah.
He was overweight and had a stutter.
Yeah.
And so, first of all the stuff Carolyn Bryant accused him of saying.
Yeah, he couldn't.
He couldn't, literally couldn't have said it. But also, he came down and he tried to work in the fields with his cousins, and he couldn't do it. And he—it was just—he was kind of an overweight city kid.
Yeah.
And I think he was probably really getting made fun of by the country boys, who were probably deeply insecure about the fact that he was from Chicago, and were projecting their own insecurity by trying to diminish him.
So you just can play the city card.
You can just imagine.
Yeah.
The series of events.
Totally.
And you see it every day.
We
play
see
around
it here for sure.
Where people try to like protect some essential core of themselves against the Lord of the Flies. And, like, you could just see how it could happen.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, like, it's such an overused word now that it's almost become meaningless. But when I think about privilege, what I really think is having an architecture of either influence, safety, or money around you that makes your mistakes not really be that big of a mistake.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about, like, somebody whose parents had to scrimp and save to get them here. And what a devastating blow it would be for a family if all of a sudden they left and all of that investment and those hopes and dreams are just totally gone. What privilege is you act enough like a jackass that you get asked to leave somewhere, and it actually becomes the best thing that ever happened to you.
Yeah.
Like, that's what, like, so, like, I think when you imagine what it must have been like for a 14 and a 16, a 14-year-old Emmett Till, a 16-year-old Wiggle Parker, and an 18-year-old Willie Reed, they just were in a situation where they had zero margin for error in a really violent world that killed people for even looking at boundaries, much less crossing them. And the defining trait of boyhood, and young manhood to me is finding and crossing boundaries. Mm-hmm. And so their natural thing signed their death warrant in this bizarre culture they were stepping into. And so that to me felt real to people.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's, I agree with you that it's real here. You know, I'm a Woodbury boy, and I would say that over the years I've come to understand, you know, the cockiest new boys are masking some deep insecurity. Well, I mean, it's so obvious.
Well, the in every case, the accusation is almost always the confession.
Totally. What do you mean by that?
I mean that, like, when people are accusing other people of something, usually I think what they're doing is really admitting that they're guilty of whatever it is they're accusing the person
of. Yeah, or another one I like is, what we most dislike in others is what we most dislike in ourselves.
That's
deep down, it's a shadow part of ourselves that we're not happy with or not comfortable with. But
it's
a demon.
I will kill the parts of me I don't like by destroying that in other people.
Yeah, exactly.
And first of all, it doesn't work.
No.
But it's the thing we talked about yesterday. There are two kinds of people, the kinds who want to be just like their father and nothing like their father.
Yeah.
I mean, that all flows out of that exact same thing. I mean, like, it would be interesting to be here and just understand how different every person who walks through that door is in terms of what... I feel like every story about someone is, what is the central complication of someone's life and how on a daily basis do they go about solving it?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's actually, that's the whole thing. And it would be interesting in this job because everybody who comes through that door, they have very different problems to solve.
For sure.
I mean, it's just, it's incredible. Like, and so you just imagine... You know, they all look the same when they're all wearing orange and black ties, but, like, everybody has a wholly unique set of problems. It's just really interesting. Like, this would be a really... Because you're catching people at... By the time they get to college, they're essentially formed.
I agree.
Like, this is a rare job where the person they are walking across the stage is 100% not the person they were when they arrived. And so you have to have a very flexible culture that allows people... to try on different costumes until they find...
Yeah, it's a great way of describing it.
Like, it's really interesting. You just watch, like, they go from a jock to they really love Widespread Panic to they really... Or they're really into Thomas Merton to they're really into... Like, it's just, you sort of see... Then they really like Led Zeppelin. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you just see the sort of...
Wheels are turning.
Yeah, it's really interesting to sort of, you know, see who showed up wearing a letter jacket the first year, who leaves in a tie-dyed T-shirt, and the other way around. And, like, it's just... It's just like, it's a wild time to get to watch people in their lives. It's like, really, it's like, I don't know, it's a very odd thing.
So that's your MO, is to find the deepest struggles that a person has and try to understand that in the context of their lives.
In the context of their daily specific lives.
Right.
And it's, and by the way, those things are always changing. So I sort of think that, like, stories need to be letters from a place and time, both.
Yeah.
My central complication, my one today might be different than my one tomorrow.
Sure.
But it's
always evolving.
But but you always want to sort of know, like, okay, what's, these guys now are trying to get to the finish line without doing something stupid in the last month.
So let's pivot a little bit.
Yeah,
You've immersed yourself in the world of sports for many, many years.
Yes, sir.
You might tell us a little bit about what you're doing, but I'm interested in you kind of reflecting on a couple of those biographical vignettes that you've shared in The Cost of These Dreams. You've also written one recently that I loved, all about Coach K. Help us understand some of the central challenges of these massive figures in our public sports life, like Jordan or Coach K.
My favorite detail about Coach K is his office was always on the sixth floor of the Duke basketball building, the one that's, like, right there by Cameron.
Yeah.
All the other coaches... locker rooms and the team meeting rooms are on the fifth floor. John Shire had his big office built on the fifth floor. He didn't take Coach K's on the sixth floor. There's a back stairwell that led from right from Coach K's office down out onto the fifth floor. They bricked up that stairwell.
Oh, wow.
So Coach K can't, like, it's to protect him from his own worst impulses. he has to let John Shire be the basketball coach.
No, wait, they just did that after his retirement?
Yes.
They bricked it over?
Yes.
So he can get to his spot.
But he can't go down the back stairs to the... He has to take the elevator and walk past the receptionist like everybody else. They bricked up the staircase. At his request, I'm certain. Nothing happens in that building. It's like, you're the headmaster here. They're not bricking up your hallway without you agreeing.
Right, but he would have known that this is going to be really important
for this is
my successor.
And actually, the central complication of his life is how he both wants Duke basketball to survive without him, and his worst nightmare is Duke basketball surviving without him. Do you know what I mean? His complication and greatest goals are the same.
Yeah.
Which is where it gets really complicated.
Yeah.
He's an interesting cat, too, man. I think you could tell a lot about someone if they're still friends with their childhood friends, even after great success.
Yeah.
His best friend is the guy he grew up with, was in elementary school with this guy named Mo. Uh-huh. And, like, when Coach K lands in Chicago to recruit in the Duke Challenger, Mo is at the FBO to pick him up in his beat-up Saturn. And when Coach K would go to recruit until his mother died, he would always, after the recruiting, he and whatever Duke assistants were there, would go to her little three-room apartment in sort of the Polish hood. She would make them dinner, and then they would stay there. And he would sleep on her couch. He's Coach K. He's a coach of the U.S. Olympic team. He's there recruiting.
Sleeping on a couch.
He's sleeping on his mom's couch. Like, he never, ever lost or broke faith with the version of himself that first learned how to dream.
Uh-huh.
And, like, I think that that's definitely related to why he became Coach K. The other thing I made sure to do is come up with some sort of mnemonic device to be able to spell his name in case he asked me. Mm-hmm. So it's Crazy Zuski, KrzyzWski. That's Crazy Zuski. Because I just was like, this is going to be really embarrassing if I try to make a big show of how much I've thought about Coach K's life. And then he just looks at me and goes, okay, big boy.
Spell my name.
And I'm like, this is like, I can't.
K.
K. That'd have been really funny. K. He went to West Point.
Yeah.
I love the idea, the Army football coach, I believe this is true. I think the Army football coach today still lives in Red Blake's house.
Yeah.
I think the football coaches live in the football coach's house, which I love stuff like that. But I also love that Red Blake's offensive and defensive coordinators was Tom Landry and Vince Lombardi.
Wow.
Were his offensive and defensive coordinators.
That's cool.
And I'm just like, well.
You think Coach K learned a lot from the decline of Bobby Knight and the demise of Bobby Knight?
He learned an incredible amount and, in fact, very specifically modeled himself on not being him.
Yeah.
Bobby Knight did a lot of really catty, insecure things to Coach K as Coach K eclipsed him.
Yeah.
Like, Bobby Knight really was not, in the end, revealed himself.
Yeah.
His demons ate his urges to have good character. He just was a bad person, and he didn't start off that way. Mm-hmm. I just think he lost himself.
Mm-hmm.
I think Coach K developed himself in the third act of his coaching career as this is who not to be.
Yeah.
And that he molded himself. Like, he had such front row seats to what the fake version of the real thing looked like.
Yeah.
I know Coach K is polarizing. I could not have more respect for a guy.
Yeah, that's cool.
Like, I really think he's the real thing, and I think he's smart, and I think he's funny, and I think he's really self-aware. I think he's incredibly intense still.
Yeah. Must be really hard for him to be retired.
I bet he's a disaster at it.
Yeah.
I haven't talked to him because, like, he's still in that building.
Yeah.
What he needed to do...
Yeah, is move
to a beach.
Yeah.
But, like, Coach K isn't going to do that. I thought he should go be the Army basketball coach.
We had our own version of this at Woodbury. The headmaster who was here when I was a boy was Emmett Wright.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of him.
And he retired, and it would have been so much better if he had just gone to South Carolina or gone to Georgia.
Did he live here?
He bought a house right across 15.
Why would you do that?
And he golfed here every day.
Every day?
And it was a disaster.
Well, it's also because the new headmaster's direct reports are always going to go around you.
Yeah, it was a tough
to the
time.
Old guy. Like you are, the whole system breaks down
because
you actually have no authority.
Yeah, and so there was no version of the concreting over of the stairwell. So it was tough.
So did anybody ever sit him down and just be like, dude, you got to stop doing this?
I wasn't around to do that, but it was Shakespearean in some ways and sad.
Well, King Lear is a hell of a play.
Sad.
You know, like, all those things are, like, the hardest thing in the, what's the Hunt for Red October? The hardest part about playing chicken is knowing when to flinch.
Yeah, right.
And, like, nobody ever wants to leave too early.
Right.
But, boy, you sure don't want to leave too late.
That's right.
Because, like, we all inevitably, I think, will become caricatures of ourselves.
Yeah.
Like that, the great John Updike quote I love, the mask eats the face.
Yeah.
Like that happens almost universally.
The mask eats the face. What about Jordan? What's his central challenge?
How to deal with the fact that he used to be Michael Jordan.
Mm.
I think we all deal with that. He is just doing it in a supercharged, extreme way.
Mm-hmm.
But he is facing a reckoning that all of us will face in miniature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dealing with your own diminishment.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been doing this Boston Celtics story. There are two guys left on all of those Russell teams.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Cousy,
mm-hmm.
who is 96 and alive, and then Satch Sanders, who is 86 years old and living in a nursing home, and his wife just died. And so this story hasn't run yet, but I'll pull this one thing up because I sat with him, an 86-year-old man in a nursing home, where every time somebody dies, they hang a portrait of them in this room that has blue wallpaper. And so the guys at this nursing home called Dying Going to the Blue Room. And I had this incredible conversation with him about what it's like to age. He's at that weird age where he said he feels like they should teach classes to young people on aging and they should let old people teach them because he said there are all sorts of things that he wishes he'd have known. He said, you have to understand that today is the best you'll ever be. I was like, what do you wish someone had told you at 48? And he's like, that you will be diminished a little or a lot every day that passes. And that every morning when you wake up, that is as good as you were ever going to be. And you don't age like fine wine. That is not true. The focus you spend as a young man on your intellectual life, you have to spend that same amount of focus on your physical life to stay as healthy as you could possibly stay, because now you're just trying to buy years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, and he saw the look on my face, like, like that's the bleakest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah,
I think the beauty of these stories about great athletes, whether it's Coach K or Michael Jordan or whomever, is you start to read the story because they're unicorns.
Yeah.
But by the end of the story, hopefully you feel deeply like they're human. Universal, and that just because it's happening in a dramatic way doesn't mean the underlying central complication isn't something that we're all going to face.
Yeah.
So like, I really find tremendous power in seeing how people deal with these outsized, huge problems.
Is Jordan lonely?
I think he probably was lonely. He's got kids now. Yeah.
And a new wife. That's a source of joy for him.
Of joy for him. And his new wife is fabulous.
Uh-huh.
And so she's been really good for him because I think she makes him, like, she made him go back to Wilmington, North Carolina and drive her around and give her the tour, which he hated but ended up really liking.
Uh-huh.
And, like, no one, what he said to me, he goes, man, women can make you do some stuff you didn't want to do.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, but like she made him engage in that part of his life.
Mm-hmm. Touch that.
Yeah. And like, and that was really interesting. I don't know. I think he's really competitive.
Yeah.
I think he's really into marlin fishing.
Uh-huh.
And by all accounts, is very good at it. They've got these big boats. He's got one of those things with the North Carolina Flare, those big fishing boats. I can't think of the name of it. But you'd know it if you saw it. I mean, they fish hard.
Yeah.
And he's got a crew that are really good folks. I mean, I think he's putting a lot of energy into that.
What about Urban Meyer?
Oh, God, Urban. Urban's father was a real piece of work. He used to make Urban, like, recite Latin while he lifted weights in the kitchen or something. If Urban would strike out looking in a Little League baseball game, he would make him run home next to the car.
Mm. Seriously?
Yeah. But Urban didn't stand a chance.
Oh.
And so Urban is someone who is caught between his own myth in his head of what he thinks a football coach is supposed to be versus his own understanding of how this business works and his deep desire to win in it. And I just feel like he's somebody who is self-aware enough to understand he doesn't like the person in the mirror but isn't strong enough to do anything about it. And I think that leaves him in a... He's also deeply Catholic, even though he's not now. I mean, he's Catholic, and he's born again, and he's loves self-help gurus, and he, like, He's just, I've never met somebody who is constantly looking for belief systems. Mm. He also, like...
Just to give him some structure and some path.
I guess. I like him. He's interesting. I mean, that job definitely broke some. I mean, you talk about, like, there's a difference between a former addict who's in recovery and has dealt with the underlying issues that the drugs or alcohol were masking, and then somebody who's just a dry drunk, who's just white. We all know he was just white knuckling.
Yeah.
And I just sort of feel like he's out of the game, but mm-hmm. I feel like he's just white knuckling it.
Let's close. It's Masters Week.
And, oh, yeah.
Listeners might know that I'm not the world's biggest golf fan in the world, but it is Masters Week, and you wrote about that, and yep. It'd be a nice way maybe to close the circle as you think about your wonderful dad.
There are many times when I sort of would pick up the phone. I mean, his cell phone number was 662-902-3702. Hmm. I haven't dialed that number in 20 years.
Yeah.
I remember it was we kept paying his bill for a while, and then somebody at the office must have stopped, because I remember the first time I called it, and it wasn't his voicemail, and I remember being really pissed
man.
Off. Oh, man. Because I was like,
yeah,
I'll pay the
cell
phone bill. It would have been nice to call him here. I loved Masters Week because he loved it. I felt about the Masters the same way. Like, every time I ever watch a James Bond movie, he's in the room. Guns of Navarone is on Netflix right now. Mm. And that we must have watched that movie 100 times. You've got me in the mood to use this thing. And by God, if you don't think of something, I'll use it on you. And every time I watch that movie, he's in the room. Mm. My wife says it's that... when I turn that movie on, I inevitably will be asleep in 30 seconds. And she says it's because I feel really comfortable. Hmm. She's like, you've never seen, she's like, you hadn't seen the end of that movie in 20 years. And I feel that way about the Masters.
Yeah.
Like, I like to have it on. I love the Episcopal liturgy.
Yeah.
And like, I love that we do this in remembrance of you. And I mean, I just feel like the ritual of communion, mm-hmm. like the metaphor of it is real. And I don't think it just applies to God. I think it's a guide for every relationship in your life.
And you went with him to the Masters.
It was interesting. We had just started to sort of like be friends as adults. I remember I paid for one meal mm-hmm. in our entire life. Mm-hmm. I had a week off of work, and I just remember I was on the way to the Atlanta airport mm-hmm. To fly somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I just called him, and I was like, hey, man, can you just go to Memphis right now and get on a plane and fly to Atlanta? Mm-hmm. And I'll just sit here in this airport till you get here. And then when you get here, we'll buy tickets to go to the beach. Mm-hmm. And so he was like, yes. So I just sat in the airport, had a couple of beers, waited. He rolled in. We bought tickets to Fort Walton Beach or mm-hmm. whatever it was and walked right over to the gate and flew to Florida. And
that's great.
But it was like, so we just sort of were in the stages of like, hey, man, what are you doing right now?
Yeah.
Because like I move around. You could have Freud would have a field day with the amount that I'm on the road.
Uh-huh.
Like, clearly I'm running for something.
Yeah, what are you masking?
No, that's 100%, dude. Is there a face left? But, like, I'm going constantly.
Yeah.
That would have been fun to be like, hey, man, can you meet me here? Can you do this?
I really appreciate you, and I really appreciate your message last night, which I think resonated with Woodbury's culture, and especially the commitment to emphasizing memory over erasure.
Making honor a real thing.
Yeah, it's a culture of integrity.
That's right. And like not having it just be some words people say.
Yeah. You've come back and we're grateful to you and happy right that you've been here, and thanks for being on the podcast.
My pleasure. I had a lovely time.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Woodbury Podcast. We hope you found our discussion insightful and engaging. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please consider subscribing, rating, or leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. Stay tuned for more conversations in the future. And remember, the conversation doesn't have to end here. Connect with us on Woodbury Forest School social media, reach out with your questions or comments, and let's keep the dialogue going. Until next time, take care and go Tigers!